from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1918, when a strange new illness began killing people quickly in large numbers. 102 years ago, medicine and technology were very different. A new book explores the history of pandemics from 1900 through the current coronavirus. Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey is a public health practitioner, and Dr. Allison Cavey is a medical historian. Their book, Viral Pandemics, From Smallpox to COVID-19, explores what we know about viral biology and how global interconnectedness has contributed to worldwide pandemics. In the book, they write, quote, "When the 1918 influenza pandemic occurred, viruses were known only as a mysterious group of tiny microbes that were infectious, filterable, and required living cells for replication. But their structure and function remained unknown," end quote. In the ensuing years, science and research began to make some changes, and by the 1930s, there were questions about a vaccine, about how many strains of flu there were, about why some of the early trials were disastrous. Well, we've learned a great deal in the last century. Today we're wondering, have we learned the right lessons? Have we learned enough as we attempt to deal with this coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19? Our guests guide us through the lessons of history this hour. Welcome to Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, a retired pediatric oncologist and the co-author of Viral Pandemics, From Smallpox to COVID-19. Dr. Cavey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Just a small correction. I'm a retired pediatric cardiologist. That's okay. It's no problem.
I don't want to promote or demote or even just give you a change in title. It matters. Thank you very much. Dr. Allison Cavey, a professor of history at CUNY John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the CUNY Graduate Center and co-author of the book we're talking about. Dr. Cavey, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you very much.
Ray Ellen Cavey, I'm going to start with you here. As we seek in this moment to understand what we're going through, I want to spend a good amount of time this hour trying to understand if we're applying the lessons of history well enough, and essentially whether through your lens at least we're applying the lessons of history to the right kind of policies and actions. But before we even do that, I mean, there's been a lot written on these kinds of subjects. Why did you see an opening here? Tell us what your goal with this book is.
Well, the book arose from my own personal learning. Right after I retired was the fall of the Ebola epidemic in 2014, and I realized how little I knew when I heard President Obama talking about it on television and calling it a worldwide security risk. I learned that they were looking for healthcare professionals to go and work, and so I volunteered. I was ultimately rejected, but that led me to read widely about Ebola and to recognize that viral pandemics are really on an escalating spiral, and that we are seeing them more frequently, closer together. And I think our experience right now with COVID-19 is really a perfect exemplar of that.
Okay. And Dr. Allison Cavey, what's your goal with the book?
Well, I'm a historian, obviously, and so my goal is to use the history of virology and the history of public health efforts in the face of viruses to remind us that what might seem like minor efforts, such as wearing face masks, what we now call social distancing, quarantining, are important and successful means of corralling diseases that we have often in the past poorly understood. So I'm hopeful that starting with what we now know about COVID, instead of depending on a vaccine to fix everything and allow us to, quote, return to normal life, we'll instead have a common sense approach to public health endeavors that all of us can participate in and that have been often more successful than very expensive and sometimes dangerous vaccination efforts to control contagion in viral and other kinds of diseases.
Well, and so, you know, I mean, let's just take the last 24 hours, Allison. I mean, as you say, instead of just waiting for a vaccine to sort of in one 24-hour period turn our lives back to, quote, normal or back to pre-pandemic times, I think more people are kind of coming around to the idea that there's not going to be just a single vaccine day where we all have parades and everything goes back to normal and everybody hugs each other and people show up at the office. I take that point. At the same time, you have a president right now who said last night, as he returned to the White House, conveniently timed right when the nightly newscasts were hitting, to say we should not be afraid of this. We should not let it dominate our lives. He took off his mask, presumably still in a state of possibly infecting people, and walked through the White House, asking a lot of employees to be back at work in the White House. Is that an example of living our lives as best we can before a vaccine, or is that reckless to you, Allison?
No, I would say that that was remarkably reckless and thoughtless and reflects both a dramatic rejection of scientific knowledge at its most basic level and a blatant disregard for the human beings who have to work with him. I was horrified.
How did you see that, Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey?
Exactly. I was just horrified. I had some small hope that his own illness would make President Trump realize that anyone can get this and that masks can protect us. And I was devastated with a platform like the one he created, as he does almost daily, that he used a platform to give exactly the wrong information.
Do you, Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, do you have any doubt that his actions in the last 24 to 48 hours could cost more lives?
I think they definitely could. I think he's telling people to disregard the information about social distancing and using masks. He's actively promoting dangerous behavior.
I take it you agree with that, Allison Cavey?
Absolutely. I think what's so important for people to remember right now is that regardless of political affiliation, viruses are contagious. And you might feel like your support for one political individual requires that you do dangerous things, but it is absolutely important that you not do so. Your life has to be more valuable than your political convictions, as to the lives of the people around you who might not share those convictions.
It doesn't really matter what your political affiliation is or who you support. The virus could care less.
Well, and Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, you know, we've talked about healthcare policy in the past. That's certainly an ongoing national debate. And your book reminds us besides just the lessons of history, the fact that when we have seen pandemics, there has never been sort of a fully equal medical system. And this past 4 days, 5 days with President Trump is an indication that there will be people, in at least in this medical system, who get prioritized care, who get the top doctors, who get experimental medicine, who get all the promising new therapies that many people can't receive. Do you see the last 5 days with the president's infection? And frankly, do you see the lessons that you and Allison outline in the book as pertaining to the debate, pertinent to the debate about medical systems, about whether it's a Medicare for all or universal health care or not, or do you see that as separate?
No, I mean, obviously I think of them as completely unified. And I think the pandemic has outlined the incredible differences in terms of race and ethnic identification and income that have made some people infinitely more susceptible to this virus. And I just was astonished last night, quite honestly, to hear him say that, you know, there's just great care available. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, I'll just call up my helicopter to take me to the hospital. I mean, the bizarreness of the idea that anyone listening to him is on the same level in terms of their ability to demand care. And in almost every other first world country, care is unified. Even very advantaged people are not going to get dramatically better care than those who are less advantaged. And that's the situation here.
Talking to Drs. Ray Ellen Cavey and Allison Cavey about their new book, Viral Pandemics, From Smallpox to COVID-19. And, you know, certainly there are historical details that if you're not a medical historian, you probably didn't know about. And I want to talk a little bit about vaccines, if we could, with our guest, because I think some of the lessons of what science has tried to do with vaccines in the past is instructive. Of course, it's not 1933 now. It's 2020. It's a very different situation. But you're right that in 1933, at the time, as scientists were in pursuit of an influenza vaccine, at the time they believed that all influenza infections were caused by a single strain that was discovered that year. But a vaccine, Allison Cavey, a vaccine, at least the progress in those early years, it was not going well. What was happening?
So I think one thing that's really important to remember is what the world was like during that period of time.
Yeah.
We were in the middle of a world war. There were two very serious pandemics that occurred between 1916 and 1919, or 1921, if you want to extend the flu to its final big summer blast. And those two epidemics were encephalitis lethargica and influenza, and they were passed along across Europe and into the Americas, of course, starting in Asia for the flu, with troop movements. We'd never seen this level of global mobility. So all of our money, all of our energy was invested in the war. At the same time, on the home front, a significant amount of energy was invested, of course, in controlling the flu. And what we see is a very local response in terms of public health, with some very big successes in some cities that had aggressive public health responses, like St. Louis, and some unsuccessful responses in cities like New York and Philadelphia, which were more engaged in victory parades and political expressions of support, and they were less capable of controlling the virus. In terms of the vaccine, we did not really understand the influenza virus very well. It, for many, many years, researchers followed the sort of fake trail of swine flu because there was the theory that perhaps influenza came from the swine flu version. And as a result, vaccine efforts were unsuccessful. And we have yet to produce a coherent and 100% effective vaccine for the flu because it's such a mobile and highly versatile virus, which is capable of mutating very quickly. That does not mean that I'm saying you shouldn't get a flu shot. I do think you should get a flu shot. I'm just saying that in this case, vaccines and public health efforts, or vaccines should be considered part of a successful public health effort, not a solution from which people can move on and never consider their risk again.
It was 1928 that an American scientist, Richard Shope, was studying swine flu. And I think the book just reminds us, you're right, just how kind of fumbling in the dark science was at the time. But do we know, did they think, Allison, that something close to 100% was achievable?
Well, I mean, they hoped that, but no, I would not think that anyone, even in that period of time, thought that a 100% vaccination rate was possible.
Yeah, and so I've tried to kind of cure my own ignorance on, it's amazing how much you learn when you're in the middle of a pandemic, but there's still so much to learn, of course. So help listeners understand, maybe, when we think about a viral pandemic like we've seen with COVID. COVID is not in the category of influenza. There are real questions about whether we can expect something better than a 50% vaccine, a 70% vaccine, a 30 to 40%, and what those would mean at different levels. And then, frankly, throughout history, what we've been able to achieve with varying diseases. And I'd love to ask both of you, if you could, to kind of take us through history and how we've done in terms of achieving vaccines, timelines. We'll talk about that as well. But I think that will frame what listeners might view as achievable and realistic when we think about what might eventually be a COVID vaccine. Allison, can you start with that?
I'd actually like to hand this over to Raelynn to begin, because she really understands the virology at a level that I think is far more important,
sure,
than my ability to convey it. Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah.
Well, I think you raised such an important point, Evan and Allison, that, you know, each virus is different. And that is probably the key lesson that I learned in writing this book, is that it's the whole thing, the prevention and the treatment and the possible prevention, they all come down to the virus itself. So just to use a couple of examples, the smallpox virus is a very, very stable virus. So it was, relatively speaking, easy to develop a vaccine, and relatively easy, and of course I could talk for hours on this and I won't, but relatively easy to achieve a very high level of success, since the virus did not mutate very much. So once you developed an effective vaccine and delivered it, people were immune. I'll give you another example where things are not as good, and that's HIV. That's an ongoing pandemic. We're talking 40 years now. We're talking 35 million people dead, an incredible ongoing global pandemic. And from the very beginning, from the time the virus was identified, scientists and physicians have been trying to develop a vaccine, and we are still unsuccessful in developing a vaccine that is in any way effective. So there's a huge range there. With this virus, with COVID, it's a relatively stable virus, not like the smallpox virus where it's 100% stable or close to it. There is mutation with this virus, but I'm not fearful that we're going to have the situation that we do with influenza, where there's so much mutation, any vaccine you develop is going to be out of date because the virus itself is mutating and there are new forms causing the flu.
You are not as concerned about that in that regard?
Not as concerned as I am with influenza. Influenza, it's proven itself to be a very difficult virus to get an effective, a universal vaccine. We don't have a universal vaccine. So I'm not as worried about that. But we don't know yet. We absolutely do not know. I'm so pleased to know that we have ongoing virus vaccine development, international efforts really moving as quickly as they possibly could, but we do not have one piece of information yet to tell us how effective any of these possible vaccines will be in preventing actual infection.
Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, we now know in the last 5 days that the White House is seeking to relax some of the rules on the track for a vaccine, possibly with an eye on declaring a vaccine achieved and ready for production. That declaration could come before November 3rd. If that happens, will you view that as legitimate or purely political?
I'm afraid at this point it has to be viewed as political because it takes time. In order to see whether a vaccine is effective, you have to allow it to potentially protect people from infection. So it's not like they're deliberately infecting people with the virus to see if the vaccine will prevent it. They're letting people in all over the world be exposed to the virus as they would be in their lives and seeing whether those who received the vaccine are protected versus those who received a placebo shot. So it's going to take months to have that information.
Dr. Allison Cavey, if we see an announcement from the White House or the CDC or both before November 3rd that says we've achieved a vaccine, will you view that as legitimate?
No. I'm afraid that my trust in the scientific method and in our peer review process and clinical trials requires that we see that solely as an effort to continue the narrative that we have, quote, triumphed over the virus and that we have, through patriotic scientific funding, managed to produce a vaccine that works. But in the absence of appropriate clinical trials and thorough human trials, I cannot call that anything but political.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments as we talk about the history of viral pandemics with the authors of a new book, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program. It's connections@WXXI.org. We're talking about everything from smallpox to polio to influenza, the various influenzas, HIV, AIDS, SARS, Zika, Ebola, and yes, COVID. And Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, you know, people will hear about this book and assume that it came about because of COVID-19. What was the process like for you and how did COVID-19 impact it?
Well, actually, the book was due at the publisher at the end of February. And as you know, the pandemic started in the end of December and really was public in January. And at the beginning of February, the press called me and asked if I'd be interested in writing a chapter on COVID. So the whole month of February until the book was due, I spent studying the evolution of this brand new pandemic. And it was exciting and terrifying to do that. And as you know, in this country, the month of February, I got to reflect everything that happened in China and the beginning of the pandemic globally, But that's where it was when I had to submit the manuscript. And I asked, and I was grateful that they allowed me to write an epilogue, because that allowed me to say what I knew was going to happen, which was that this was going to be an incredible major global pandemic, and it burst out in the first week of March and has been exploding variously in different parts of the world ever since that time. So it was in some ways an incredible education to be involved in following this pandemic as it evolved. Exciting, exhilarating, terrifying. And also from a public health standpoint, I feel devastated, because in this country, we have not utilized the public health knowledge that we have to control it. And we could have done, and we still can do.
Well, let's talk about that theme then, because that's a big theme of the book, is understanding the history of viral pandemics from smallpox to COVID-19. And we would all hope applying those lessons, knowing that every pandemic is different and the characteristics are different. I mean, as our guests have been telling us, there was a lot learned in the 1930s when scientists were hopeful about an influenza vaccine and then really struggled with the trials and began to understand that there were different strains and mutations, and that a 100% vaccine was not going to necessarily be achievable, but it still mattered to try to pursue the best possible vaccine. Whereas when it comes to other diseases, maybe you can get close to 100% vaccine. With COVID, we don't know yet. But when you look at all of these lessons and how we combat these diseases over the last century, and you look at what's been done since January, Dr. Ray Allen Cavey, let me start with you. You know, you talk about that sort of terror and exhilaration. You're completing a book on pandemics, and now all of a sudden you realize we're about to be living through one. But did you feel like you were ahead of the world and you were trying to convince people you knew, your kids and grandkids are going to be out of school? People are going to work from home. This is going to happen. Did you find yourself trying to convince a skeptical group of friends in public? Were you frustrated with the way government was talking about it? What was life like for you then?
Well, I did feel like I was ahead of the curve. And anyone who spoke to me during that time, that was pretty much all I talked about, because I could see it happening, because I was studying it and I could see it spreading. And I said over and over again, you know, we are in for it. This is going to be a global pandemic. Did I know that schools were going to be closed? Did I know all the details? No. But let me read you the last paragraph of the chapter that I wrote in February. Let's see here. What do I say? As this potential global tragedy continues to unfold, our whole planet needs to be prepared with plans for population education, communication, movement management, and personal protection. This includes securing adequate supplies of personal protective equipment, drugs, diagnostic tests, supplies, hospital beds, and healthcare personnel, all critical shortages that could develop anywhere in an explosive global pandemic. This is a people's war, and we are all in this together. We must be ready.
Mm. Allison Cavey, what was it like for you in really February, even into March? I mean, I recall in early to mid-March, had friends and people I knew who were still planning on going on trips. And, you know, you're starting to have these conversations going, you know, this stuff's not going to happen. And you can understand why there was skepticism at first, because as much as you're a historian on viral pandemics, most of us alive today had not lived through something quite so serious and acute when it comes to public response. What was it like for you when you were talking to friends and relatives about what was about to start changing?
So ironically, the first weekend in February, I had been on a plane and I got back. And that evening, a friend was having a 60th birthday party, and I went to the party and I started having a sore throat at the party. And I thought, oh, you know, I'll just go home a bit early. I'm sure I'll be fine. And I was not fine. I developed relatively high fever and the cough that wouldn't go away. And with relatively small amounts of exertion, I couldn't breathe. And I am 42 and annoyingly healthy. And at the time, we all thought it was, quote, the flu. But within a week or so, it was pretty clear, because I was still sick. 2 weeks later, I still had this cough that wouldn't stop. And with exertion, I couldn't breathe.
And it became clear over time that it is likely that I had COVID in among the first people in the Northeast to do so. And thank goodness, none of the other people with whom I had dinner were infected, and none of the people that I had been in that meeting with had any symptoms. So it doesn't seem that I became a super spreader, for which I'm very grateful. But my personal experience with what could have been COVID or could merely have been yet another bout of the flu was enough to make me very, very cautious about the ways that people were behaving in public, even when we didn't have big reactions. So Mom and I, Raylan and I, were actually together in the second weekend of March, right before everything closed down. And at that time, we were among the only people who were elbow bumping instead of shaking hands or giving hugs. Yeah. And people said, oh, this is, you know, come on, it's going to go away. And I remember that first weekend in February, I was talking to my friends about the virus, and they said, oh, you're a historian of medicine. What do you think is going to happen? I said, I think this is going to shut down the world. And they said, oh, you know, you humanities people, it's always with the drama. You can't shut down the world anymore. It's a global economy. These are people in finance. You don't know enough about this. And I said, okay. But I think, and 3 weeks later, they said, how did you know? So it's the only time my degree has ever been useful. I'm really very impressed.
Well, now that's one thing, taking your degree and your study of history and the work that you were doing at the time, coincidentally. It's another to look at the policy decisions. And even leaders in government, you know, they're not medical historians. They're not scientists generally or researchers. They have to rely on different teams. They have very, very large behemoths of government to move and to make change. Allison Cavey, how do you rate the United States' response to this pandemic, especially as it relates to how other countries have responded?
I think consistently, when we have had the chance to listen to scientific or medical evidence and make logical, evidence-driven decisions, this administration has refused to do so. Public health, environmentalism, we have rolled back important measures that are scientifically driven ways to control disease and improve the environment. And I am just embarrassed, to be frank, that the United States and Argentina are uttered in the same sentence in our inability to control a virus that could be hampered, significantly limited, by relatively simple public health efforts. Because we don't have a federal narrative that is governing our public health efforts, we have piecemeal efforts. Wonderful governors like Cuomo have done really, really well in terms of shaping our response to the virus. Other governors like Ron DeSantis in Florida are an ongoing embarrassment. And I think it is awful to live in a country where we can't even agree that science and medical evidence are more important than political affiliation in determining our response to a medical crisis.
Well, Ray Allen Cavey, how do you see the response? How do you rate it in this country vis-a-vis others?
Well, I think it's been a terrible response. And really, you don't need to ask me, because, you know, here is a country that has a quarter of the deaths and has a huge proportion of the cases. It's ludicrous. And we have all the resources here, every kind, to deal with this. And one of the things that Alton has said several times is that the public health measures are straightforward, and they aren't terrible. They're really, we have learned that if we social distance and wear masks, the rate of infection with this virus drops way down. And in fact, China showed us that right from the very beginning by isolating Wuhan so that the disease would not spread widely through China. And they were dramatically effective. And here we are with advance notice to the government, to the president, about how virulent this virus was. And no measures were taken during the entire month of February. And that's when the disease was spreading. And one of the things about this virus that we didn't know that has proven to be such a problem is at least 40% of people are asymptomatic. So that means the virus can be spreading without a huge awareness of a new disease process. And that's an early lesson learned that we're still trying to deal with.
Well, on that subject, after we take our only break for the hour, I'm going to get Andrew's question. He wants to know if there are similarities to how diseases have spread over the years. And he's specifically asking if other pandemics had asymptomatic spread like we're seeing with this pandemic. We'll ask our guests about that. And then we've got a number of listeners who are asking about herd immunity. They want to know if previous viral pandemics produced herd immunity in any sense, because that is one of the consistent refrains you hear from everyone from one of the president's medical advisors to many on the political right saying, let's just let people live their lives and gain herd immunity and we can all get on with it. So that, of course, science has essentially rejected that with this pandemic. But I want to be fair and make sure we ask our guests, Dr. Ray Allen Cavey and Dr. Allison Cavey, if they have a different view of herd immunity when it comes to its viability there. So their new book is called Viral Pandemics, From Smallpox to COVID-19. It's out now. They were working on this book before COVID-19 was known to the world. And boy, you talk about timing. It ends up being a book that feels very timely for the moment and an important look at history. And let's take that break and come right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Supreme Court Justices Alito and Thomases have indicated in a recent dissent that they do not agree with the case that paved the way for equal marriage, for same-sex marriage in this country. It's an indication that the Supreme Court could be ready to make a significant change on marriage, particularly if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed. We'll talk about the future of marriage and the state of the court Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to ask our guests a couple listener questions. Andrew wanted to know if there are similarities to how these diseases have spread over the years, and specifically asking if previous viral pandemics have had asymptomatic spread. Dr. Ray Allen Cavey, what do we know about that? You might be on mute, Dr. Cavey. I can't hear you, but we'll see if we can switch that up. Oh, we've lost Dr. Ray Allen Cavey. Let's see if we can reestablish that call. And while we do that, Allison Cavey, while we get your mother and your colleague on there, do you want to take the question from Andrew there?
Sure. So most viruses are most infectious in their first day or two that you're feeling sick. So you will start to feel sick and be infectious. As we've noted, and these are respiratory viruses. COVID is unusual because you're at your peak of transmission about 24 hours before you show symptoms. But of course, we're not talking about the elephant in the room here, right? Because remember HIV? People spread HIV for up to a decade before they experienced any illness that caused them to go to physicians in the early days of that pandemic. In America, for example, people were finally coming to emergency rooms or to their physicians with Kaposi sarcoma or pneumocystis carini pneumonia when they had T-cell counts below 5. And they had often been infected for, as I said, up to a decade. So when we talk about viral transmission or asymptomatic spread, I think it's worth remembering that the biggest plague of our age, the modern age, is HIV, and it has asymptomatic spread.
Okay. And Dr. Ray Allen Cavey, do you want to weigh in as well on Andrew's question about whether there are any similarities over the years and whether it's asymptomatic spread or other similarities to how viral pandemics have spread?
Well, Allison has brought up the virus that has the most incredible period where people are asymptomatic, and that's HIV. But another one that many people are still familiar with is polio. The vast majority of people who have polio are completely asymptomatic. Only about 10% have a mild disease, and less than 1% have the severe paralytic polio picture with which we're also familiar. So, there, of course, viruses do have a long tradition of being asymptomatic and causing disease. In terms of spread, the way we live now, we have optimized opportunities for viral spread all over the globe because of air travel, because of population explosion, so people are living closer and closer together. And because many viruses arise in animals and then jump over to people, the fact that we're destroying animal habitats and living closer and closer to animals, that allows more and more opportunities for jump over and spread from animals to humans of a virus that we have no immune protection at all.
Yeah, I want to ask a question that came from a number of listeners as well in regards to herd immunity. There's a some refrain in certain political circles that herd immunity is the way to go. I think there's probably a misunderstanding of what's happened in places like Sweden, which don't necessarily have herd immunity, might have pursued slightly different policies. Sweden has had restrictions on gatherings. They've had plenty of economic issues as a result of this, and they've had a much, much higher rate of death than their neighbors in Scandinavia, but it doesn't mean that they've achieved herd immunity. And I think some point to Sweden, there's some listeners asking if we should get on that path. We know one of the president's advisors has talked about herd immunity with this particular pandemic. Let's talk a little bit with both of you about how you see this pandemic, herd immunity, pursuing it in any sort of fashion, and what we've learned about herd immunity over the years. I'll start with Dr. Rael and Cavey.
Well, I mean, ultimately, almost every pandemic ends when there is herd immunity. But if you look historically, most recently, the virus that achieved herd immunity so dramatically was Zika. And not everyone in North America is as familiar with Zika, but it was a phenomenal pandemic in South America and Central America and spread into the southern United States. Dramatic numbers of cases and a horrific fetal complication with microcephaly, a devastating neurologic problem. Over a one-year period, I'm sure everyone remembers, Zika was everywhere. Concern about traveling to countries where the mosquito that carried the virus was prevalent, et cetera, and a lot of efforts right at the end of the Obama administration to develop a vaccine. And before they were able to develop a vaccine, the virus disappeared. And that's because herd immunity was achieved. So many people became infected over a two-year period in South America and Central America that herd immunity was actually achieved. This virus is not as aggressive as the Zika virus, so it would take a lot longer than that. And it's estimated that as many as a million people in this country would die before we achieved the 70% infection rate that is estimated to produce herd immunity.
No good reason to pursue it that way, it sounds like.
Well, we're pursuing because we're not adequately preventing people from becoming infected, but the time course to achieve protection is long, and the morbidity and mortality along the way is high.
Yeah, and just following that point, I'll turn to Allison, Cavey. You know, if you had a friend say, look, you know, your book makes it clear that these pandemics end when there's herd immunity, let's just get there as fast as we can. Let's put everything back open. Everything open tomorrow. Yes, we will have more infection. A lot of it will be asymptomatic. Herd immunity will happen faster, and on we go with our lives. What do you say to that, Allison, Cavey?
Well, remember when the governor of Texas said that people over 74 should be perfectly willing to give up their lives for the economy to continue?
The lieutenant governor, yeah, Dan Patrick.
Yeah, yep. Sorry. Yeah, so that's sort of what I would point to. If you are willing to die for this economy, please go line up on the right. I am not willing to die for this economy. Now, I understand there are essential workers who don't have that choice. And my students are often among those people. And we had students die of COVID over the spring because they were working in places where they couldn't stay home. They were working in nursing homes. They were in hospitals. They were doing child care. For those people, there's no choice. So how can we say that it is a good idea to sacrifice people in order to have economic progress and potential, and I'm emphasizing the word potential, immunity, because we are not 100% sure that simply having this disease guarantees you immunity for any length of time. We've already seen repeat cases after 6 months. Another example I would provide is our failure to be able to control measles. Due to the inaccurate information,
circulating about the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, many people have chosen not to vaccinate their children. And in high schools, elementary schools, and universities around the country, we have seen measles outbreaks that challenge what used to be an easily maintained herd immunity. So this is my second argument about why vaccination in this country is not an easy answer. Many people simply refuse to vaccinate, even when the vaccination has proven to be effective and safe. So I am strongly opposed both to the idea of herd immunity and the remarkable disregard for human life that I think it reflects.
Let me get a phone call from Kevin in Rochester with a question for our guests, Drs. Ray Ellen Cavey and Allison Cavey. They're the co-authors of Viral Pandemics, From Smallpox to COVID-19. Go ahead, Kevin.
Thank you, Evan, for having me on. Just real quick, I've looked at some real controversial evidence about how viruses actually spread. And the 1918 pandemic really comes up a lot and how it was spread. So if the transmission rate for these viruses is contact, how do you explain the transmission rate worldwide and how fast it actually gets transmitted worldwide? When back in 1918, we didn't have the same travel, means as we do today, and how it, you know, we can explain how it spreads today, but how do you explain how fast it spread back then? And I think that just brings me to the whole thing of the actual, what the virus is and how it actually spreads, that, you know, perhaps we have more to learn about it and the actual ecology of it, you know. I'll listen. Thanks.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you. Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, do you want to start with that?
Well, there's no doubt we need to learn more about this virus. We're still learning more every week. But in terms of spread, with comparing this to the 1918 pandemic, what happened with the 1918 pandemic is that the disease actually arose primarily in the troops in Europe. It was brought to them from, some people say from the United States and other people say from China, but that's where the concentration of the disease was. And it was right at the end of the war, and we're talking about millions of troops who were transported back to the countries. The spread was much more aggressive than it would have been at any other point in history, in that part of history, because air travel was not something that happened. But we're talking about really millions of men being transported back to their home countries, and many of them infected with and or carrying the virus when they went.
Allison Cavey, when it comes to global interconnectedness, Kevin is making a point that today it's not really a wonder on how a pandemic is going to spread now. I guess I'm wondering in the future, with all the talk about travel restrictions, et cetera, it would seem to me, and I certainly could be wrong. I mean, your book certainly makes clear that when we thought about Zika, when we thought about SARS, MERS, there was a lot of concern right away that that was going to be what this pandemic has become. And for varying reasons, it didn't happen. So maybe sometimes it's luck. Sometimes we make pretty good actions. But it seems harder and harder to contain future pandemics. I'm curious to know how you see the ability to contain future pandemics.
I think we have very low chance of controlling future pandemics for viruses or other forms of disease that are highly transmissible. So particularly respiratory viruses, if you combine them with air travel, you're looking at a very high transmission rate. You're also looking at global spread on a very fast scale. Just to underline what Ray Ellen was saying, the 1918 flu epidemic spread starting in 1916 because of troop movement and, remember, trench warfare. These young men were crowded into tiny trenches and their immune systems were relatively shattered by the time they got out. So they might go out on leave, get exposed, come back, transmit, and die. Also, military training was a very significant location of spread because, once again, young men under stress, crowded together, are going to be perfect viral transmitters. For future epidemics, I think if we look at a fast-moving virus like Ebola, we have a better shot of controlling spread through containment, but that's very aggressive containment, and that's a very fast-moving virus that presents and burns through relatively quickly in exposed population. We know that for slow-moving viruses like HIV, and of course, Raylan raised the important example of polio, we're terrible at this. And our world is faster, we travel more, travel is less expensive, and for many of us, our jobs depend on travel in a way that was not true in 1918. So the more we understand viruses and other diseases, the better we can attempt to counter them. But I'm going to reiterate for the 14th time until you're all annoyed that public health narratives, public health efforts are relatively easy and they're something we all can do. And in 1918, that public health narrative was actually translated into patriotism, that if you didn't spit in public and you washed your hands and you avoided public gatherings, you were a better American than someone who didn't. And although that is just as much of a political and propaganda message, I think it's an important one for us to consider at this point in our very divided country.
I take that point. And so let's close the program with a few minutes on the lessons to apply now. And our guest said earlier this hour that there needs to be more of an understanding on how to live sort of among or with COVID-19. That doesn't mean endorsing a full-scale going back to how we were before the pandemic began in March, at least March here in this country. But it does mean understanding our own role and how it spreads and what we can expect, what we can do to mitigate, knowing that while we're all hopeful for a vaccine, realistically, we're not going to have a single day where everything changes with the snap of a finger. So, Dr. Allison Cavey, what do you want us to know, either with lessons from history or just understanding public health as we think about how to continue living and living sort of among COVID-19 for a while, if not indefinitely?
So I really like this phrase, living with the virus, and it's one that we've learned from HIV. Living with COVID and other highly transmissible viruses, particularly respiratory viruses, is going to require some changes in our daily lives that are manageable. I hope to be teaching in person in a mask. I understand that this is going to be a little bit weird for everybody, but I think it's the safest thing for my students and for myself. It means I'm going to have to learn to speak a little bit more slowly, a little bit more clearly, but I'm happy to do that in order to respect my students' obligations to their families and to their professions. I think mask wearing, which is already common in many cities in Asia because of air pollution, is going to become something we consider much more normal in the next decade or two. Hand washing, not something Americans were ever very good at. I'm hoping will become something we're very good at. A bunch of us make jokes that our knuckles are cracked from all the repeated scrubbing. But between the options of death from respiratory failure and kidney failure, and a few cracked knuckles, I'll take the knuckles, thanks. Not standing so close to people. In New York City, on a subway, I have frequently felt that I was much more intimate with strangers than I had ever intended to be. And of course, the subway is a prime example of an urban spread zone. So I think we're all going to have to be a little bit more willing to be a little bit more thoughtful in how we interact in public spaces. But I think we can do that. I think the world can afford to slow itself down by 5 minutes or so for each person in order to save lives.
Okay. Dr. Ray Allen Cavey, what do you think?
Well, I completely agree with Allison. But I would also add that we're learning ways that environmentally we can address this as well. And she brings up the example of the subway, and there's a recent study from China talking about ventilation in a bus and how people who were sitting next to the windows in a bus where there was an infected person did not become infected, whereas those who were sitting in on the interior row of the bus did. And so I think that translates into the knowledge, and there's tons of other evidence about people becoming infected when they're indoors in a low ceilings place for long periods of time. So if we change the way we ventilate our homes and our public spaces and our public transportation, and I think those are changes that should be addressed, I think that will also decrease the risk of this virus and every other airborne virus going forward, because this is not the last viral pandemic we're going to deal with. There will be another one.
Well, as we wrap here, just some news that we're seeing today. The White House is trying to block new COVID-19 vaccine guidelines from the FDA. And the reason that the White House says so is, according to Mark Meadows, among others at the White House, the pharmaceutical industry has objected to the tougher standards on grounds that the FDA is making it difficult to get a vaccine out in quick enough time to help people. Pfizer's CEO weighed in today saying, not true. We never talked to the White House about that. And we wouldn't. But we can expect in the next few weeks probably an announcement that there is some vaccine that is imminent, despite what science is telling us and despite what some of the experts, like the ones who've been on the program today, have been telling us. The new book is called Viral Pandemics, From Smallpox to COVID-19. It is out now. Dr. Ray Allen Cavey, it's a pleasure. Nice to have you on the phone. Really appreciate your perspective. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for the history.
Thank you so much, Evan, for having us on.
You got it. Dr. Allison Cavey, my pleasure as well. Congratulations on this book. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You got it. That book is out now. So much to continue learning. We'll try to do that every day on this program. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon. We'll talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.